UNFPA's 2021 State of the World Population Report, titled My Body is My Own, Claiming the Right to Autonomy and Self-Determination, was recently launched and has received much global acclaim. The report focuses on what it means to have power and agency to make choices without fear of violence or having someone else decide for us, as well as details the realities for millions of people who are denied these rights and this power because of their gender, race, sex, sexual orientation, age, ability, or geographic location. I'm Sarah Barnes, and you're listening to Friday Podcasts, hosted by the Wilson Center's Maternal Health Initiative. In today's episode, I had the privilege of sitting down with Dr. Naheed Tubia, one of the advisors to the State of the World Population Report and a panelist at several of the country launches of this report, including the U.S. launch hosted by the Wilson Center. Dr. Tubia is an expert and activist in sexual reproductive health and rights and the first woman surgeon in Sudan. She worked at the Population Council in New York as a technical advisor to the World Health Organization and several UN agencies, and as adjunct professor at Columbia School of Public Health. She is most known for her work to stop female genital mutilation from an African feminist perspective. She is currently the director of the Institute of Reproductive Health and Rights in Sudan. Today we sit down to further explore the report and the importance of bodily autonomy. This episode was made possible through the generous support of UNFPA. Good morning and welcome to Friday Podcast. Dr. Tubia, it's such an honor to have you with us today.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm very delighted to be with you today. I'm calling in from Sharm el-Sheikh in the Red Sea, and it's beautiful and sunny, and I can see the sea from here. So I just wanted all the listeners to join me in this nice moment.
Oh, well, thank you very much for that. Since we are sitting here today to talk about bodily autonomy and UNFPA's 2021 State of the World Population Report, I would really love it if you could talk to our audience a little bit about, you know, what is bodily autonomy and why is it important?
Yes, I'm actually so unbelievably delighted that I was part of this report, because I think maybe I didn't think about it all the time clearly of what is it that I am actually working for and what's some dedicated, you know, decades of my life for. I call it women's rights, women's health, women empowerment. But when the term bodily autonomy was presented to me and I was asked to be the advisor on this report, it was a hooray moment. Every human being really has the right to own their body, to own their decisions, to own their choices regarding their life, their futures, how they want to live, who they want to partner, whether they want to have children or not, what kind of families they want to have. So all these choices are all wrapped up in this concept of body autonomy.
Yes.
And at the same time, while we would not allow legally almost anywhere in the world for people to own each other or to clearly and condoned by any kind of legal system for one person to own the decisions or in some ways own the body of somebody else, this is something that people haven't really thought about. Mm. Where women and girls and others, they're in some ways lacking body autonomy. They don't own your body completely and the decisions around it. So it's something that's happening all around us, but sometimes we haven't really stopped to think about it. And now suddenly there is a word, there is some language for it. I deserve to be autonomous. I deserve to own my body. And I think that's a huge step forward.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And you mentioned being an advisor on the most recent State of the World Population Report, where they're primarily focusing on bodily autonomy and self-determination. And you've been involved in several launches of this report, including the U.S. launch with UNFPA and the Wilson Center. I'm wondering, through all of these launches and being an advisor during the creation of this report, has anything really stuck out to you as a pivotal moment for the other advisors or the communities or the listeners during these launches? Has anything really struck you?
Yes, I think what I kind of mentioned in my previous intervention is people know it and don't know it. Like, it's something innate in you. You know, almost I say like children, babies kind of know who they are, and they're very defensive and very protective of their bodies and their decisions. So it's something almost innate in us, yet it's a eureka moment for many people. At the same time, of course, I think, especially when the second was the world media, and it did receive some kind of, no, we can't allow this. This would be a step too far by some people, obviously people coming from more conservative environments. But also even within the people who developed the report, the researchers, the advisors, the UN staff, many of them are people who've researched issues on sexual reproductive health and rights, who are legal rights, human rights people, and they are very much for body autonomy. But at the beginning, in the first couple of weeks when we were negotiating what we will involve, there was a hesitancy of almost self-censoring. It just felt like, wow, is this gonna pass? Is this gonna kind of ruffle too many, you know, people who don't want us to say things so boldly? But eventually and very quickly, they also sighed a sigh of relief and started jumping in with more clearer ideas, with more, and everybody almost with a smile. There was some resistance from staff within UNFPA because they are operating in very conservative environment. But as we said to them, you know, the principle is there. Everybody has the right to their bodily autonomy. We cannot compromise on that. However, you can find ways to find out and negotiate how you actually create the conversations and the dialogue.
Right. And did you find that most of the hesitancy, you know, the report really looks at three different aspects of bodily autonomy and, you know, the right to seek a doctor whenever you need it, the right to decide if and when and how many children to have and the use of contraception, and then also the right to determine who you would want to have sex with and the right to say no to sex. Those are three of the main categories that the report really focused on. Was there a particular area in there that you found the most resistance?
I think discussing sexuality openly. I think that was the biggest. To the point that we had the resistance in a aspect that I didn't expect, actually. As you know, there is case studies within the report, and we deliberately made sure that these case studies were chosen from people on the ground who are doing real work, who are concerned. But also, by the way, we also made sure that the case studies do not just say the tragedies. We had to find, you know, also give some positive stories, happy stories, how people solve things.
Right.
So one of the stories was from Egypt. And it was from an activist, I think it's even a physician activist who works with women on the ground on FGM. Mm. And she states that, you know, once you start talking about FGM and its effect on women's sexual pleasure and response, and, you know, that's when the women's eyes start open and they really start talking to you. Mm. So it was a very positive thing. And of course, personally, as somebody always worked on FGM, I always believed that you have to deal with the sex issue. Otherwise, you can't just talk about bleeding and infection. So somebody quite senior then objected and said, no, we can't talk about sexuality with FGM because that will just close our ability to work in many countries, which is, by in my experience, is not true. But anyway, so something as, yeah, I mean, to some extent you would feel is a bit more innocuous than talking LGBT or abortion or sex workers or some of the other controversial and sometimes not decided upon in terms of policy. But this one, yeah, I mean, I thought it wasn't as controversial, but somebody tried to block that story. Unfortunately, I had the opportunity to overrule that and say, you know, this is comes from the ground, from the field, from people's voices. How can you stop it?
Right. Well, and that actually leads me to the next thing that I was hoping you would speak to a bit today. And that is your experience working within the field of FGM and working. I know in your bio, it mentions that you approach FGM from an African feminist lens. And I'm curious what that really means to you. And I think our audience would be interested in your work in this area.
Yeah, the way I would describe African feminist perspective or feminist voice anywhere is that women speak for themselves. Yes, they need allies, whether they be men, professionals, policymakers, but fundamentally, it has to be the voice of women. And historically, and to this day, a lot of programs that deal with FGM do not bring forth the voice of the woman herself, the girl who was cut, the woman who's married after or has a boyfriend or whatever, and is starting to suffer with her sexual issues, whether emotional or physical. The experience, the shock, the trauma, all that has not, that voice was silenced. So one of the things we did very early and we still continue to do, even in a place like Sudan, is to bring forth the voice, number one, the first person who is important in this, the woman herself, the girl who was cut.
Right, right.
And then also there is this huge issue of, oh, but her mother is a woman and she was cut. Why is she perpetuating it? Mm. Well, there's all, again, feminist analysis about why somebody or a woman who's been abused or has had trauma decides to repeat it on her daughter, not because she's evil or ignorant or all the ideas that people had about African women who cut their daughters. These are traumatized women. These are people who haven't dealt with their own trauma psychologically. They are trying to be part of society and not find the strength to rebel against what is expected of them. And we know a lot of traumatized people actually repeat the trauma. So there was never that kind of angle or lens to see this woman. And once you actually speak to this woman, I've worked in many places, Sudan, Egypt, Mali, and had very similar experience where women, the younger women first are kind of confused, don't know how to speak about it. And then once you give them the space and the safe space, I would have to say, because it is, if you talk about something as horrible as that happened to you, you almost in some ways repeat the trauma. Right. So you have to create safe spaces, comforting and embracing spaces. And once they start talking, you can't shut them up.
Right.
They just grow. And that is true even of the older women. They sit there and they're very polite and they just repeat whatever the agency funding them is saying. But then you have them talking a little bit more and starting to talk about their personal experience and what they really feel. And I've had women in their 80s or 70s who at the beginning were kind of the supposedly grandmother who perpetuates or insists. And some of them have insisted that their granddaughters are cut. But once you start touching their own feeling, their own experience, something else happens. And that's what I'm saying about, let's take the leadership to stop FGM. It may need a little bit more work. It may need a different kind of methodology than just giving, messages, and big boards or, posters with, with a razor and a few drops of blood and that kind of, sorry, but crude kind of an approach to social change. Social change is a very complicated thing. But once you get to the people who are affected, the people who really feel the pain, and once they open their minds and voice and free themselves, you can't stop them. And that's where change happens.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's incredible and really, really interesting perspective. I'm wondering too, I think another piece from the report and particularly related to FGM, but I think also to the right to have decisions about, make decisions about contraception or the right to say no to sex, is how bodily autonomy over one aspect of a person's life then leads to autonomy in other spaces. What has been your experience of, if you don't have that autonomy as a young person in one space or as a married or partnered woman in another space, what does that mean for the rest of your life and your experiences?
Yeah, I think that's an amazingly important question. And yes, maybe some people in the United States who are your audience who probably can make the connection better. But I want to say we get that criticism a lot, given that we are come from a poor country economically. And even the progressives, even those who want more social justice or political democracy and, you know, human rights even organizations, you start talking about bodily issues and women's rights to their body or sexual reproductive health and rights, and they kind of say, oh, this is a luxury issue. Come on, people can't eat, they don't have housing, education, you know, girls' education more important, housing is more important, political participation, and of course, poverty and economics. Of course, these are all very important. But if you really stop for a minute and say, okay, a person who cannot make decisions about their body, about whether they continue education or not, you know, because somebody else owns them and owns their decision, who they get married to, when do they get married, that will affect whether they can get employed or not, whether they have children or not. If you think about it, it's actually is the basis for all these other issues that we want to get at. How can a girl get education if she doesn't have choices or somebody else controls whether she goes to school or not? How can she have professional career or political participation if she's having popping up a kid every 18 months or 2 years and having 6, 7, 8 children to take care of? And by the way, I talk about even educated women in a place like Sudan who are still getting 5 and 6 children because contraceptive availability is very poor. And a lot of the decision is not in women's hands. So yes, I think the answer to your question is without bodily autonomy, everything else is not gonna happen. Or if it happens, it will happen in a way that still enslaves the woman. Maybe she's employed, maybe she even earns better than her husband. But if she doesn't have her autonomy, if she's not free of violence, she might still be living in a very controlled life, despite her economic progress or educational progress or, you know, any other benefits.
Yeah, this is such an important point, and I'm really glad that you made it. Even we at the Maternal Health Initiative, we're always trying to stress that importance of women's reproductive health and rights toward these greater issues of, you know, society and economics and even security. And it's always a struggle to continue to put forth concepts and issues around maternal or sexual reproductive health into those conversations. Because as you said, it's such a good point that people think of it as this luxury or this add-on when really, for women, it is essential. It's the most immediate and essential aspect of our being that does link into these other facets of our lives. So I think that that is really, really important. And I'm glad you made those points. And I'm wondering too, how do we use bodily autonomy and everything that is involved in that concept as a road forward for women and girls and gender equity? Another large concept.
Yeah, let me just start by saying, responding to the first part of what you said. I think what we can use the language of bodily autonomy is the foundation and the launching pad for any freedoms, for all quality of life, for all, not even human rights, for citizenship rights. Okay. So if we say it's the foundation and the launching pad, then all the others come out of it. Maybe we can develop language like that to just confirm it there as the basis. In terms of how do we move forward? You know, Sarah, I've been thinking about this, and within the launch, I tried to stay, of course, within what the report was about. And, you know, it was something new, so we didn't want to complicate too much in people's minds. But I have been thinking about another dimension of it since then. And it kind of responds to your question, where do we go forward? To me, as I have mentioned in the launches, bodily autonomy is more understandable than sexual reproductive health and rights. Right. They are in some ways the same, although bodily autonomy is wider. It involves also gender, you know, protection from gender-based violence or any kind of violence, accepting people's rights to all choices, including life choices, and not necessarily just SRHR. But what I came to is this. When we use the language of sexual reproductive health and rights, which is fantastic language, and I was part of at least bringing a lot of the rights issues into it, it's very important, but it's very long. Mm. The average people, by the time you finish the 4 words, you lose half of the people. Sexual reproductive health and rights. And believe me, people with PhDs say, or even professionals like in health, what does that mean? They always say, And even when you try to explain it, it's just a lot.
Right.
And the reason why I thought bodily autonomy is can be understood by many more, because as I said earlier, it's internal, it's innate. And here is what the thinking I've had, because it kind of affects how we move forward. Sexual and reproductive health and rights is an umbrella under which we ask professionals, governments, health professionals, as well as legal professionals, to ensure their existence and their availability to every person. So it's a more systems kind of language or systems demand. Bodily autonomy, while it will, of course, need systems to be adjusted and improved, whether within the health system and the legal system, it's actually about the person themselves. What we need to do is to get people to believe in something they already have inside them, just to get it out, that they have the right for bodily autonomy. Yes, we have to say to the system, people have the right to bodily autonomy, but it's about the people, not about the systems. And I think regardless of cultures, regardless of religions, because again, a lot of the resistance is going to come from cultures that are conservative against women, or religions that are interpreted in a conservative way that is not favorable to women, as well as legal systems. You know, dictatorships love to use women's suppression and other minorities to survive, like here in the Middle East, for example. Mm-hmm. So I think what the bodily autonomy brings in the actual people who are concerned, it's for the people everywhere to know that they have the right to bodily autonomy. They put the pressure on the systems. And then we also talk to the systems and people. So I don't know if I'm explaining myself. It's a people's rights. It's an individual belief that everybody should have, as opposed to just appeal to the systems. But right. Then if people have that belief, regardless of who they are, then the systems will have to obey.
Right. Yeah. So then, Dr. Tuvia, what is the role then of government or international agencies? You know, what are your thoughts on the US or the UN's role in protecting bodily autonomy?
Well, first, of course, the UN, I really applaud UNFPA for the courage that they have produced this report and increasingly handling, you know, more what people see as peripheral or controversial issues. But it's okay, somebody needs to push the envelope as they take. Other UN agencies need to follow, and even that may take some time. I've recently worked with the regional offices of WHO, for example, and they're way behind even in understanding SRHR properly. They go through the, you know, the language and the routines, but they don't really understand it very well. So we have to do something within the systems, particularly the agencies that are supposed to be, you know, reference agencies. They have money, they have, you know, they have ability to put pressure on governments. So that's the UN agency. Of course, all governments should be held accountable if they do not try to provide bodily autonomy to everybody, regardless of who they are within their country. So it has to be accepted as a landmark, as a marker to be measured by. Are you protecting everybody? Of course, that including, of course, women, girls, disabled people, but also the people who are thinking LGBT issues are not here, they don't belong to us, or abortion is not something we want to deal with. So, you know, slowly we can push to make this everyday accountability markers for every government. When they report, it will take a while, but I think we'll get there, just like we did with, you know, if you remember, or if you had read it in history, you know, contraception in 1967 was considered an evil intrusion in Africa.
Right, right.
And now it's an everyday activity. So that's number one. With regards to the US, at least where, you know, we have a period, hopefully of 4 years, maybe 8 years of progressive US administration, where this kind of language becomes what US money also follows or leads. You know, they still work, you know, provide contraception and family planning and, you know, women's rights and all the works on gender equality that USAID and other US agencies support. But if they start also adopting this very progressive language and incorporating it into their guidelines for proposals, for programs, then it also helps push that new vision and that new lens of looking at things.
Yes, absolutely. And I was just thinking as you were speaking too, a lot of times we sit and we talk about the issues and the statistics and the data, but you've been good in these launches and in all of our previous conversations too about really moving the conversation to solutions. I'm wondering, as one of our final notes on this podcast today, what are your thoughts on the immediate solutions that you see as possible and as that first next step towards bodily autonomy?
As I said, I think incorporating the language in any programs and calls for proposals or partnerships with local organizations, whether, you know, independent NGOs like yours or the US government. But I actually, just what I said before, just, you know, add the language, push on it, incorporate it. I mean, if you have a gender equity program, you can just by saying, you know, we are coming from the idea that every human being, and especially girls and women, have the right to bodily autonomy, then it filters down to everybody. And before we know it, people are talking bodily autonomy, but also not to, as a tokenism, but we try to make sure that people understand what that means. But that could be incorporated in the details of the technicalities of every project, every program, every grant.
Right.
I just want, before we go, to emphasize something that I have been talking about lately. And I think I'm getting some responses or some ears opening, but not as much as I'd like. And that is, we have to stop being afraid of the Muslim world. Islam, just like any other, theocracy or any other even theory or ideology, can be as flexible and expandable as everything else. We need to discuss Islam and women more. We need to allow Muslim women to speak up and say, enough, we need our autonomy. I am somebody who lives in the South, who believes in the South, although, as you know, I carry too many nationalities. But I just want to say, please, there is no them and us, and there is no you and us. We are all together in this, whether we're American, we are Egyptian, Sudanese, Canadian, English, whatever. This is for all people, and especially for all women. So let's work together rather than categorize ourselves as different, coming from different backgrounds or different contexts.
Thank you very much. That's a great way to end the podcast today, Dr. Tubia. This has been an incredible conversation. Thank you so much for the work that you do and for taking the time to be with me here today.
Thank you, Sarah. It was my pleasure.
Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to this edition of Friday Podcasts. And thank you to Dr. Tubia and UNFPA for your continued support and partnership. To learn more about the State of the World Population Report or to view the U.S. launch event in its entirety, visit the .mom column on newsecuritybeat.org or follow us on Twitter at @Wilson_MHI. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Friday Podcasts wherever you listen to podcasts.